the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, it's been called the Western disease. Heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. More Americans die each year from the three big ones. And more Americans have been diagnosed with either being obese or overweight. What's behind this? And how much does diet play a role? Joining me on the program is New York Times bestselling author Nina Teckholz. She's the author of a book called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. I know you're probably saying right now, that doesn't make sense from what I've been taught. Nina, welcome to the show. I want to begin in the year 2000. You moved to New York. You start doing a column on restaurant reviews. It was also the time you stopped worrying about eating fat. What happened?
First of all, thank you for having me on your show. I am a journalist, and one of the sort of side things that I was doing was reviewing restaurants for a little throwaway paper that was like a neighborhood paper, and it didn't have money to pay for meals to do those reviews blindly. So we just had to go to the restaurant and ask the chef to send out whatever he or she thought was the best foods that the restaurant had. And so I was a vegetarian. Meaning I ate some chicken and fish, but no red meat, no butter, hardly any cheese for almost 25 years. And at that point, I would have ordered stir-fried vegetables or chicken breast or something low-fat, definitely. And instead, I found that chefs wanted to send out to me things like usually red meat and foie gras and tripe and other kinds of interesting, unusual dishes, and mainly things that I had really not eaten before or had not eaten in decades. And I found them to be interesting and earthy and textured and creamy delicious, these cream sauces I had been avoiding for years. And I also found that I just effortlessly lost 10 pounds that I had struggled with for years. And I thought, wow, that's great, but I'm sure I'm going to have a heart attack from eating all this red meat and cream sauce. So I went to my doctor and had my cholesterol levels drawn, and they turned out all to have improved in the time that I was eating red meat and butter and cream sauce. So that was a mystery to me. Here I was eating exactly the opposite from what I'd been told and strived to eat the opposite as from what I had striven to eat my whole life, and yet I was getting healthier and thinner. So that was just a big question mark. Why was that? That's not really directly what led to my book, starting my book. It was instead a kind of investigative story that I did on trans fats for Gourmet magazine, also around the same time. And that led me into the world of interviewing researchers in this field of fat and cholesterol who had wild stories about their science being suppressed and people trying to drum them out of the field or their research grants taken away for having unpopular ideas. And all of that just opened my eyes to this rich, interesting world of fat, saturated fat, cholesterol. You know, these are the things that we've obsessed about most in our dietary recommendations for 50 years. And here was all this information that everything that what we had seemed to think was true was maybe not. Maybe it was entirely wrong. And that's what really sent me down the rabbit hole of writing my book, which took almost a decade of research, really, to try to get to the bottom of that question.
You know, as I started, many Americans die each year from heart disease, cancer, diabetes. There was a study that 75% of men are overweight, 60% women. Nina, how did saturated fats as being unhealthy get ingrained in our national diet?
Saturated fat. That is really the central theme and focus of my book. Saturated fats are found in red meat and dairy, why we've been told to eat lean meat and low-fat dairy for so many years, but they're also in coconut oil, palm oil, why we've been told not to eat those tropical oils. But saturated fats, you know, all foods are a combination of fats. So fatty fish, mackerel, has actually more saturated fat per 100 grams than does red meat. And there are all kinds of surprises like that. So all foods contain a mixture of saturated, unsaturated fats. But it all really started in the 1950s when there was a panic over the rising tide of heart disease, which had come from pretty much out of nowhere. In the early 1900s, heart disease was very rare. And then it had quickly risen in the 20s and 30s to become the nation's number one leading cause of death. In 1955, President Eisenhower himself has a heart attack and is out of the Oval Office for 10 days. So you can imagine the sense of urgency and panic surrounding this issue. What causes heart disease? Nobody knew. And there were a number of competing theories. Some people said it was vitamin deficiency. Others thought it was due to auto exhaust, more and more automobiles on the road. Other people thought it was the type A personality. But there was one researcher named Ansel Benjamin Keys, who is a researcher at the University of Minnesota, and he stepped into this vacuum and proposed his idea called the diet heart hypothesis. And that hypothesis held that saturated fat and dietary cholesterol, such as found in egg yolks and shellfish, those two things in the diet would cause your blood cholesterol to rise, clog your arteries like hot grease down a cold stovepipe, was his analogy, and that would give you a heart attack. And that diet heart hypothesis really captured the imagination of his nutrition science and medical colleagues. And it must be said also that Ansel Keys turned out to be an absolute tireless promoter of his own idea. He was uncommonly charismatic. He could, according to his colleagues, argue anyone to the death. He had an outsized faith in his own beliefs, and he was able to get himself onto the Nutrition Committee of the American Heart Association, which was at that time in the 50s really the only group giving people advice on how to avoid heart disease, such that in 1961, the American Heart Association issues the very first advice anywhere in the world telling the public that they should cut back on saturated fat and cholesterol in order to prevent heart disease. That was really the very tiny acorn of advice that grew into the giant oak tree that we now have today. I mean, it was really adopted. It was adopted by our government. It was adopted by other governments around the world. But one of the things my book goes into in a lot of detail is, like, there really was almost no evidence, no rigorous evidence for that advice when the American Heart Association issued that recommendation in 1961, and that subsequent efforts to prove the diet heart hypothesis right, despite testing tens of thousands of people on that idea, they couldn't prove it to be true. But it really started in this moment of crisis and public health urgency, kind of the same situation that we feel today about obesity and type 2 diabetes. Like, we need ideas. And so it was a moment when Ansel Keys' idea really prevailed.
Let's talk about cholesterol, which is deemed to be the primary component of heart disease. Let's talk about that and how that developed and how people like Keys use that as a main argument for their diet recommendations.
Cholesterol has been just a complete obsession of nutrition science researchers and cardiovascular disease researchers, too, for 60 years now. And they thought cholesterol caused heart disease. They had evidence from people who got with a rare disease who had fatty buildups on their bodies, and they looked at those fatty buildups and they discovered they were cholesterol rich. And then they figured, they just sort of imagine that this is what must be also happening inside the artery walls and causing heart attacks. Anyway, this was all very speculative. Now, Ansel Keys, in his time, he thought it was total cholesterol. But then trial after trial after trial showed that the amount of cholesterol, total cholesterol, that people had really did not correlate very well with your risk of heart attack and cardiovascular death. So then they shifted to LDL and HDL, low-density cholesterol, that's the bad kind, and high-density cholesterol, that's known as the good kind. And that's sort of what we live with today. But again, they long-term tracking of these experiments, they have not been able to show that lowering your LDL, getting your bad cholesterol down through diet, maybe that works with statins and drugs, but if you do it through diet, they cannot show any benefit in terms of your cardiovascular outcomes. LDL, in other words, is a very poor predictor of your heart attack risk. HDL and your good cholesterol, and actually it's the HDL to triglyceride ratio, turns out in numerous long-term experiments where they track this over time and measure cholesterol markers and follow people until they have a heart attack or die, your HDL to triglyceride ratio turns out to be the most reliable predictor of cardiovascular outcomes. And I just qualify that statement with, of the things that you are on a normal cholesterol panel, there are other more sophisticated markers of cholesterol and inflammation and various things that might be better predictive, but most people don't normally get those tested. But the HDL to triglyceride ratio is really pretty accurate. And if you'll allow me to explain what controls HDL, you go to your doctor, you ask, how do I get my HDL up? My HDL is low. And he'll say, well, you can try to exercise more and maybe drink some red wine. The fastest, best way to increase your HDL is to eat more saturated fat. It is the only food that will increase your HDL. And triglycerides, the other half of that ratio, triglycerides are driven almost entirely by your carbohydrate consumption, your grains, even things like, you know, healthy whole grains, quinoa, but definitely sugars, candy bars, all of that drives your triglycerides. Your triglycerides are just the fatty acids in your blood. And it turns out that it's carbohydrates that convert into fat in your bloodstream. I hope I've confused everybody completely now. You can transmit what you think their questions might be.
I want to get into something I did as a result of reading your book. But one of the things that struck me in reading the different studies that were done that you covered in your book, you discovered, Nina, in your research, a remarkable aspect of the nutrition research community was its lack of tolerance for alternative viewpoints. That really surprised me and is very dangerous, in my opinion.
I have to agree that it also surprised me. When I first started researching my book, I expected science, my father's a scientist, I expected science to move rationally and logically forward, where people would respond to observations, as they're known in science. And if your hypothesis cannot explain all the observations, then you know you have to change your hypothesis. And instead, what I found was this highly politicized field. In fact, when people always ask me, oh, you don't have the credentials to write about science, I say, well, I explain what my scientific background has been, which is considerable. But I say, you know, it's actually my training in studying political science that has been incredibly helpful to me, because this story is really much more about politics than about science. So what I discovered was that anybody who opposed Ansel Keys was brutally dealt with. You know, I call it the sharp elbows of nutrition science in my book, but really it's outright bullying. I mean, anybody who wrote a critical paper on Ansel Keys, he would lash back in published rebuttals, accusing them of being bought out by industry and being liars. I mean, real sort of slanderous stuff. And there's sort of the famous exchange with John Yudkin, who was a professor at University College in London, and he was the one who really suggested that our diseases, our Western diseases of civilization, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, were caused by sugar. And Ansel Keys saw this competing hypothesis as a tremendous threat and ruthlessly attacked Yudkin to the point where he just simply retired from the field because he didn't want to deal with that kind of abuse. And then there, of course, were other ways. There was, you know, once the National Institutes of Health got on with Ansel Keys' hypothesis, which it did from a very early, really back in the 1950s, it was in sync with Ansel Keys. Anyone who opposed Ansel, the diet heart hypothesis, they would have their research grants yanked. One of the leading, a very prominent scientist from the University of Vanderbilt, a biochemist, George Mann, he told me a story of when he was at NIH and a secretary pulled him out into the hall and said, you know, if you continue your opposition to Ansel Keys, you're going to lose your research grant. Mm. And shortly thereafter, he did. And I could go on and on with stories of people who can't get their papers published. One woman who was visited by executives from the margarine industry who tried to intimidate her. People from industry calling journals, trying to get papers yanked. I mean, people who were assigned to go to scientific meetings simply to heckle and intimidate the opposition. It's so astonishing. You just can't believe this is where our science comes from. But you have to remember, this is the science of food. It's multi-billion dollar industry. Much depends on it. There's a huge amount of industry money riding on the results of science. And what happened is that industries quickly realized, I mean, really going back to the 40s, the food industry realized that they needed to influence science at its very source. and they got involved in funding universities, promoting, you know, funding chairs, really getting involved in the science at the very start. So, you know, it's not a pretty picture, and it makes you very skeptical, not only of nutrition science, but you have to assume other kinds of science. And this continues today. Our food guidelines, which is a subject that I've now gravitated towards, all of the expert advice that comes out from medical associations and public health associations and our government, has the same taint of being heavily influenced by the food industry. So it's deeply disturbing.
You know, I want to get to the point where saturated fat was replaced with vegetable oils, margarine replaced butter. And the result was obesity went up, disease went up. Let's talk about that debate, because eventually a lot of these vegetable oils, then we went to trans fats. Trans fats eventually grew out of favor and really put the food industry into a dilemma. You know, because if saturated fat was bad and trans fat was bad, what do companies like Nabisco do with Oreos?
Right. So what happened when saturated fat and cholesterol became demonized are two major shifts in food consumption. And I'll just mention this briefly and then go to vegetable oils. One of them was when people cut out meat, cheese, eggs out of their diet, as Americans did, what do they switch to? Instead of bacon and eggs for breakfast, they're having cereal. Instead of steak for dinner, they're having vegetables over pasta. They're having some pasta or rice dish. So we Americans from 1970 to today increased our carbohydrates by more than 30%. That's grain, bread, pasta. That's what we were told to do, and we did it. So that is one major shift, a major macronutrient shift in the way that Americans ate, with, I think, devastating consequences, as we're now understanding, because that excess in carbohydrates is something that we clearly cannot tolerate and is very likely the source of our obesity and diabetes epidemics. The other thing that happened when we were told to stop eating saturated fats is that we were told to shift to unsaturated fats. Instead of butter, we have unsaturated margarine. Instead of the foods with saturated fats, we're supposed to have polyunsaturated vegetable oils. Canola, soybean, corn, all those oils came onto the market, and we were told to eat them, and we did. So they were invented in the early part of the 1900s. They had previously been used, these oils, as lubricants for all the machines of the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th century, and then somebody figured out how to winterize and deodorize and bleach and make it into something that looked remotely palatable for the human palate. And they came up with Crisco, which was the first vegetable oil product to be launched anywhere into any market worldwide from vegetable oils for human consumption. Crisco was introduced in 1911, and that was supposed to replace lard, which it did eventually. That's a hardened form of vegetable oils. Then we were introduced to just the oils in oil form. So during the 20th century, we increased our consumption of these vegetable oils 121,000 times. They are now 7 to 8% of all the calories that we consume, which is another huge shift in the way that we eat. They became the backbone of the processed food manufacturer industry. They are used in all cookies, crackers, chips, frozen foods, everything. That's it. They all have, you look in their ingredient list, they all include now, it's just mostly soybean oil. So, you know, we're told that these polyunsaturated oils are good for us because they lower our cholesterol. Well, again, let's just go back to what we were saying before. Is it good to lower your total cholesterol? Actually, that doesn't track at all with your heart attack risk. Is it good to lower your LDL cholesterol? That doesn't track very well at all either with your cardiovascular risk when you're lowering it by food. But we're told this is still the advice today. And what I discovered, really shockingly, again, science that had sort of been lost or silenced or unpublished or never discussed, these oils, when they were tested in clinical trials, which is the most rigorous kind of science you can do, NIH-funded clinical trials, they had people eat a lot of these oils, like, you know, margarine instead of butter, soy-filled cheese instead of real cheese, soy-filled burgers instead of real meat. They found that the people on the oil diets died at much higher rates of cancer. And they found this in at least a dozen studies. And they were concerned about that. So much so that the NIH had a series of very high-level panels that they pulled together in the early 1980s to discuss what was this so-called side effect of, you know, a healthy heart diet that it increased cancer. And they really could never find an answer to that. There still has not been an answer given to those results, and they're still not discussed. And additionally, I found that when you heat these oils, as is now, we now, most of fast food restaurants heat these oils in their fryers, they result in all kinds of degraded oxidation products that oxidation, remember the reason we take antioxidants is that oxidation is bad. Oxidation causes inflammation. And that these oils, when they're heated, they have all these inflammatory effects. And those oils enter the food, they get past the blood-brain barrier, and they are degrading into these toxic oxidation products at very high levels. It's extremely concerning. And it's even more of a problem now that we've gotten rid of trans fats. And I don't want to go too much down this little tangent here, but trans fats occur when you harden vegetable oils. And vegetable oils were hardened, as in that first instance of Crisco, because they are wildly unstable when they are in oil form. They oxidize incredibly rapidly and easily. So to harden them was a way to make them stable. And that is still true. So what they did is they hardened vegetable oils, and it was those hardened oils containing trans fats that used to be used in restaurant fryers and in restaurants everywhere for baking and cooking. And because they were hardened, they were stable. They did not oxidize as easily. But in getting rid of trans fats, restaurants have gone back to using the plain old oils, highly unstable, highly volatile, especially when heated. So that is very concerning to me now, and it was something that I explore in my book, and there are all kinds of wild stories in there about what happens when you put these oils in restaurant fryers, like in McDonald's and Burger King's, what happens because they're so unstable.
I want to go to a debate that occurred between Dr. Atkins and Dr. Ornish, and Ornish seemed to have won that debate with Atkins having far superior results. Let's talk about that.
In the 1970s, there was Dean Ornish with his very low-fat, barely any animal products, almost vegan diet, and he would debate Atkins, who was advocating for a high-fat diet that included meat and cheese and eggs. And there was one very high-level debate, I think it was on CNN, that happened in the early 2000s. You know, it's not my recollection that Dean Ornish won that debate, but, you know, he did in the larger picture in that Atkins was discredited. His ideas were not adopted by any major professional organization, whereas Ornish and his plant-based diet, that now reigns the day, right? I mean, there's almost all nutrition experts will tell you to eat a plant-based diet. So he's been a tireless and very effective advocate for that diet, which just is another political story. Let me put it this way. There's never been any rigorous evidence that the Ornish diet works. He repeatedly talks about kind of multiple trials that he's done, and he's actually only done one randomized controlled clinical trial, which is what you need to do to get rigorous data. He did it on 40-something men, only men, in a trial that included, in the intervention, there was a change in diet, but there was also meditation and dietary supplements and all kinds of mindfulness exercises, and these men were taken to this beautiful spa in Northern California, and the control group had no intervention at all. So it was not a parallel control group. And that's the evidence that he uses to support his huge empire, which is, you know, just a few dozen people, only men. And actually, at the end of his trial, two people died in his diet and intervention group, and only one person died in the other group. So that's odd. And ultimately, you can never say, was it the meditation? Was it the dietary supplements? Was it the fact that you were at a spa? Or was it the diet? You really can't tell in a multifactorial trial like that.
If you take all these books that are out, whether it's Ornish, and there's many out there, and especially I live in California, so you see a lot more of this, the land of fruits, nuts, and granola. And you have a lot of this low-fat, plant-based diet, vegan. You're seeing it more in restaurants now. So where are we today as a society? Have we moved in any good direction, in your opinion? Because if you take a look at what the government recommends, its food pyramid, the stuff that you're talking about, meat, cheese, bacon, milk, cream, that's at the top. The vast majority is carbs.
Right. That remains true. The government continues to tell all Americans to eat between 50 and 55% of all their calories as carbohydrates. And you're supposed to do that through fruits. You know, fruits are high in sugar, vegetables. Some vegetables are starchy. That's carbohydrates. And grains, lots of grains. And it doesn't matter if they're whole grains or refined grains. Those are still carbohydrates. So what I focused on now is trying to see if we can get better guidelines, because they are so influential. They do influence you even if you don't know about it. I mean, if you go to your doctor, nutritionist, dietitian, nurse, and say, how do I improve my diet? They just download the dietary guidelines. For the most part, they will give you that advice. Eat more fruits and vegetables and whole grains is their advice. And cut back on red meat. Careful about the cheese. You know, depending on who you ask, oh, they might have different opinions about butter. But, you know, that diet is not evidence-based. When they did clinical trials, which is, again, the rigorous kind of evidence you can do to show cause and effect, and put people on that diet, they've done multiple clinical trials of that diet, they show zero health benefits, no health benefit for losing weight, for fighting diabetes, for preventing heart disease, or any kind of cancer. I'm talking about, you know, clinical trials on more than 50,000 people, NIH-funded, long-term, multi-center, multi-year trials. But we just continue to recommend it. It's very hard to shift course. Like, changing government policy, changing people's minds really is a task of sort of shifting the Titanic and getting people to say, well, we were wrong about that. That's not easy.
Well, that's amazing thing is the statistics show more heart disease, more cancer, more obesity, more overweight. You mentioned that what helped you in your research was your political background, because you have the political interest of the food industry. You have the interest of the big companies like Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, Bunge. You have the interest of the drug companies who create the drugs to fight the diseases. You have the medical profession with surgery. I mean, you go to a doctor and you have something like this. What do they give you? They either operate or give you a pill. So there's all these conflicting interest groups that play into this role of diet.
And medical doctors really are given almost no education on nutrition, and what they are given comes directly from our flawed government guidelines. You know, they're really trained, and this is the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on their industry, but, you know, doctors are trained to just prescribe pills. That's what they're trained, is to identify whatever symptoms for which they might have a pill. That's their training. And it's unfortunate because, you know, now the average American is on 5 pills a day and they're not getting any healthier. That's the critical thing. You know, one of the things that the analogies I like to make is like, what if you owned a baseball team and they lost every single game for 50 years? You know, instead of blaming the players for being poor players, you turn to the coach and say, you know what, I think we need to fire that coach and get a different strategy, right? We just don't have the right strategy. And yet, when you look at obesity and diabetes, we've had increases in the rates of obesity and diabetes every single year for 50 years. And yet we continue to say it is the fault of Americans for failing to follow our advice. Right? It's the fault of Americans. They eat too much. They're slobs. They don't exercise enough. And there's nothing wrong with our advice. You know, my coach on that baseball team, he's good. It must be the fault of every single player that comes along. Well, that's crazy. I mean, the definition of insanity as defined by Einstein is to do the same thing over and over and over again and expect different results. And that's what we're doing. So I was encouraged actually just the other day when former FDA Commissioner David Kessler said, we have failed in the nutritional advice that we give people. I mean, this is what I've been talking about. We clearly have failed. I mean, we should at least be curious about whether we might be wrong about, you know, our official nutrition advice, because it has completely failed. Despite the billions of dollars spent trying to get people to adhere better to the government guidelines, we just can't seem to make any progress. Why is that? There ought to be some intellectual curiosity out there and a willingness to consider the possibility that maybe we just got it wrong.
You know, it's amazing. I have interviewed just about everybody when it comes to diet. The people that wrote Paleo, I've interviewed Dr. Dean Ornish. I've interviewed Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn from the Cleveland Heart Clinic. I've interviewed them all. And Nina, the one thing that I came away is I got confused. I'd read one book similar to Atkins that said, you know, eat red meat, cheese. This stuff is good for you. And so what I did to clear this up is I tried a couple of these diets through a company called Green Chef, which has every diet you can think of, paleo, vegetarian, vegan. But I did it in conjunction with my doctor because you talk about science. So I wanted to use the science of taking a look at my blood work. What happened to my HDL, LDL, my triglycerides? And what I found is when I gravitated more, I call it flexitarian, but some will call it keto, where I have low carbs and I have meats, that it was the best blood results. I had high HDL, my triglycerides were perfect, my cholesterol was low, everything. You know, my doctor said, whatever you're doing, keep doing it because it's working.
Well, it's one of the things that I love about this field is that, you know, imagine if you're working in environmental science, nobody really knows the answers to these big questions about the environment, and we can't do our own experiments. You know, that can only be done by labs or universities. But in diet, everybody can do their own experiment, right? You can experiment on your own body. And the reality is there's a lot of variation amongst humans about how they respond to diet. So the best information really does come from your own experience. And then people can find out for themselves. So I think what's encouraging to me is this sort of bottom-up revolution that we're seeing. This is what the science also supports, but you know that the majority of people do much better, especially people with diabetes, obesity, heart disease, fatty liver disease, they do much better by restricting carbohydrates and increasing their fats. And how much you do that really depends on your own body and how sick you are. And everybody can figure that out for themselves. The tricky thing is that you were lucky. You had a good doctor who said, keep going. Everything looks good. What has more often been the case, there's been so much bias against carbohydrate-restricted diets that, you know, people would go to their doctor and they'd say, look, everything's better. My blood pressure's down. I'm off all my medication. I've lost 40 pounds. And the doctor would say, just be careful of that dangerous diet you're on. Or that diet will give you a heart attack. That was always the criticism that was leveled at Atkins. Sure, it may help you lose weight, but you will suffer from a heart attack down the line. And what is great about the last now 20 years of science that has been done, more than 70 randomized controlled clinical trials on more than 7,000 people on carbohydrate restriction, showing it to be safe, no side effects, and to improve the vast majority of all your cardiovascular risk factors. So, you know, it seems like it's not only good for weight loss, but also good for your cardiovascular health.
Well, you know, the one thing that you brought up is everybody can do this. You can simply read up about it and then try it. And once you try it, then go get your blood tested. You know, I had my blood tested when I went on vegan and vegetarian diet, and my weight went up. And my blood chemistry wasn't as good. So I started thinking, well, there's got to be another way. So I tried the other diets until I finally found the one that brought all my levels down to where I wanted them. High HDL levels, low triglycerides, and it lowered my blood pressure and it did a number of things. Nina, as we close, I want to recommend your book because we've had a number of authors on this program of different diets. And what I like is if you are into health, if you are into pure science and you're not getting the results, I highly recommend Nina's book because it's going to open up your eyes. And the best thing you can do as an individual is simply try it. You have nothing to lose and maybe you'll come out with better health. Nina, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. The name of the book is called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And we've been speaking with its author, Nina Techholz. Nina, thanks so much for joining us on the program, and I wish you all the best and success with this book.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that concludes my interview with Nina Techholz. Once again, what really amazes me in reading Nina's book. And if you've been a listener of this program, you know we have had them all on the program, from Dean Ornish to Caldwell Esselstyn to Mr. Caldwell on the China study, vegan, paleo, keto, vegetarian. We've had them all. And this will really open your eyes. In my own case, I had to try an experiment. I tried with different diets, and then I would get working with a good doctor and make it more scientific. All right, I'll eat this way. And then after 3 months, go get my blood tested and see what the results were. And so I've mainly gravitated more. I call it flexitarian because it's really a low carb fat diet. You know, I eat red meat. I eat fish. I add red meats, proteins, along with vegetables and greens that I have are very, very low carb. And you can take a look at some of these books and you can take a look at the carbohydrate content of the foods that you eat. So you can kind of sort of judge yourself. But I don't have grains. I don't have rice, quinoa, bread, pasta, those kind of things that can add so much weight to you. Not only that, influence your triglycerides. What you'll get reading Nina's book, one of the most powerful markers of heart disease is your HDL levels and your triglycerides. That's one thing that I came away with that is so true. That is a greater marker for heart disease and health than anything else your doctor will tell you. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.